Welcome to Discourses Upon the Existence and Attributes of God, Volume 1, by Stephen Charnock. We are continuing to read at page 378 for this reading. This Reformation MP audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. Many free resources, as well as our complete online catalogue containing classic and contemporary Puritan Reform books, DVDs, CDs, digital downloads, MP3s, and much more, at great discounts, are on the web at www.swrb.com. Also, please consider, pray, and act upon the important truths found in the following quotation by Charles Spurgeon. As the Apostle says to Timothy, so also he says to everyone, give yourself to reading. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read. Renounce as much as you will all light literature, but study as much as possible sound theological works, especially the Puritanic writers and expositions of the Bible. The best way for you to spend your leisure is to be either reading or praying. And now to SWRB's reading of the existence and attributes of God, which we hope you find to be a great blessing, and which we pray draws you nearer to the Lord Jesus Christ. For he is the way, the truth, and the life, and no man cometh unto the Father but by him. John 14, verse 6. Proposition 5. This is the property of God, incommunicable to any creature. As no creature can be eternal and immutable, so no creature can be immense, because it cannot be infinite. Nothing can be of an infinite nature, and therefore nothing of an immense presence but God. It cannot be communicated the human nature of Christ, though in union with the divine. Some indeed argue that Christ, in regard of his human nature, is everywhere, because he sits at the right hand of God, and the right hand of God is everywhere. His sitting at the right hand of God signifies his exaltation, and cannot, with any reason, be extended to such a kind of arguing. The hearts of kings are in the hand of God. Are the hearts of kings everywhere, because God's hand is everywhere? The souls of the righteous are in the hands of God. Is the soul, therefore, of every righteous man everywhere in the world? The right hand of God is from eternity, is the humanity of Christ, therefore, from eternity, because it sits at the right hand of God. The right hand of God made the world. Did the humanity of Christ, therefore, make heaven and earth? The humanity of Christ must then be confounded with his divinity, be the same with it, not united to it. All creatures are distinct from their Creator, and cannot inherit the properties essential to his nature, as eternity, immensity, immutability, omnipresence, and omniscience. No angel, no soul, no creature can be in all places at once. Because they can be so, they must be so and must be immense, and so must cease to be creatures, and commence God. This is impossible. 2. Reasons to prove God's essential presence. Reason 1. Because he is infinite. As he is infinite, he is everywhere. As he is simple, his whole essence is everywhere. For in regard of his infiniteness, he hath no bounds. In regard of his simplicity, he hath no parts. And therefore those that deny God's omnipresence, though they pretend to own him infinite, must really conceive him finite. 1. God is infinite in his perfections. None can set bounds to terminate the greatness and excellency of God. Psalm 145:3. His greatness is unsearchable. There is no end, no limitation. What hath no end is infinite. His power is infinite. Job 5:9, which doth great things and unsearchable. No end of those things he is able to do. His wisdom infinite. Psalm 147:5. He understands all things present, past, and to come. What is already made, what is possible to be made. His duration infinite. Job 36:26. the number of his years cannot be searched out. To make a finer thing of nothing is an argument of an infinite virtue. Infinite power can only extract something out of the barren womb of nothing, but all things were drawn forth by the word of God, the heavens, and all the hosts of them, the sun, moon, stars, the rich embellishments of the world, appeared in being at the breath of his mouth. Psalm 33:6. The author, therefore, must be infinite, and since nothing is the cause of God, or of any perfection in him, since he derives not his being, or the least spark of his glorious nature, from anything without him, he cannot be limited in any part of his nature by anything without him. And indeed, the infiniteness of his power and his other perfections is asserted by the prophet when he tells us that the nations are as a drop of a bucket, or the dust of the balance, and less than nothing. Vanity. Isaiah 40:15-17. They are also in regard of his power and wisdom, etc. Conceive what a little thing a grain of dust or sand is to all the dust that may be made by the rubbish of a house. What a little thing the heap of the rubbish of a dust of a house is to the vast heap of the rubbish of a whole city, such as one as London. How little that also would be to the dust of a whole empire. How inconsiderable that also to the dust of one quarter of the world, Europe or Asia. How much less that still to the dust of the whole world. The whole world is composed of an inconceivable number of atoms, and the sea of an inconceivable number of drops. Now what a little grain of dust is in comparison to the dust of the whole world. A drop of water from the sea to all the drops remaining in the sea. That is the whole world to God. Conceive it still less, a mere nothing, yet it is all less than this in comparison of God. There can be nothing more magnificently expressive of the infiniteness of God to a human conception than this expression of God himself in the prophet. In the perfection of a creature, something still may be thought greater to be added to it. But God containing all perfections in himself, formally, if they be mere perfections and eminently, if they be but perfections in the creature, mixed with imperfection, nothing can be thought greater, and therefore every one of them is infinite. 2. If his perfections be infinite, his essence must be so. How God can have infinite perfections and a finite essence is inconceivable by human or angelic understanding. An infinite power, an infinite wisdom, an infinite duration must needs speak an infinite essence, since the infiniteness of his attributes is grounded upon the infiniteness of his essence. To own infinite perfections in a finite object is contradictory. The manner of acting by his power and knowing by his wisdom cannot exceed the manner of being by his essence. His perfections flow from his essence, and the principle must be of the same rank with what flows from it. And if we conceive his essence to be the cause of his perfections, it is utterly impossible that an infinite effect should arise from a finite cause. But indeed, his perfections are his essence. For though we conceive the essence of God as the subject, and the attributes of God as faculties and qualities in that subject, according to our weak model, who cannot conceive of infinite God without some manner of likeness to ourselves, who find understanding and will and power in us distinct from our substance. Yet truly and really, there is no distinction between his essence and attributes. One is inseparable from the other. His power and wisdom are his essence, and therefore to maintain God infinite in the one and finite in the other is to make a monstrous God and have an unreasonable notion of the deity, for there would be the greatest disproportion in his nature, since there is no greater disproportion can possibly be between one thing and another than there is between finite and infinite. God must not only then be compounded, but have parts of the greatest distance from one another in nature. But God, being the most simple being, without the least composition, both must be equally infinite. If then his essence be not infinite, his power and wisdom cannot be infinite, which is both against scripture and reason. Again, how should his essence be finite, and his perfections be infinite, since nothing out of himself gave them either the one or the other? Again, either the essence cannot be infinite, or it cannot. If it cannot, there must be some cause of that impossibility. That can be nothing without him, because nothing without him can be as powerful as himself, much less too powerful for him. Nothing within him can be an enemy to his highest perfection, since he is necessarily what he is. He must be necessarily the most perfect being, and therefore necessarily infinite, since to be something infinitely is a greater perfection than to be something finitely. If he can be infinite, he is infinite. Otherwise he could be greater than he is, and so more blessed and more perfect than he is, which is impossible. For being the most perfect being, to whom nothing can be added, he must be, needs be, infinite. 3. If therefore God have an infinite essence, he has an infinite presence. An infinite essence cannot be contained in a finite place, for those things which are finite have a bounded space wherein they are, so that which is infinite hath an unbounded space, for as finiteness speaks limitedness, so infiniteness speaks unboundedness. And if we grant to God an infinite duration, there is no difficulty in acknowledging an infinite presence. Indeed, the infiniteness of God is a property belonging to him in regard of time and place. He is bounded by no place, and limited to no time. Again, infinite essence may as well be everywhere, as infinite power reaches everything. It may as well be present with every being, as infinite power in its working may be present with nothing to bring it into being. Where God works by his power, he is present in his essence, because his power and his essence cannot be separated. And therefore his power, wisdom, goodness cannot be anywhere where his essence is not. His essence cannot be severed from his power, nor his power from his essence. For the power of God is nothing but God acting, and the wisdom of God nothing but God knowing. As the power of God is always, so is his essence. As the power of God is everywhere, so is his essence. Whatsoever God is, he is always and everywhere. To confine him to a place, to measure his essence, as to confine his actions, is to limit his power. His essence, being no less infinite than his power and his wisdom, can be no more bounded than his power and wisdom. But they are not separable from his essence, yea, they are his essence. If God did not fill the whole world, he would be determined to some place and excluded from others. And so his substance would have bounds and limits, and then something might be conceived greater than God. For we may conceive that a creature may be made by God of so vast a greatness as to fill the whole world, for the power of God is able to make a body that should take up the whole space between heaven and earth and reach to every corner of it. But nothing can be conceived by any creature greater than God. He exceeds all things, and is exceeded by none. God, therefore, cannot be included in heaven, nor included in the earth, cannot be contained in either of them. For if we should imagine them vaster than they are, yet still they would be finite. and if its essence were contained in them, it could be no more infinite than the world which contains it, as water is not of a larger compass than the vessel which contains it. If the essence of God were limited, either in the heavens or earth, it must needs be finite, as the heaven and earth are. For there is no proportion between finite and infinite. God, therefore, cannot be contained in them. If there were an infinite body, that must be everywhere. Certainly, then, an infinite spirit must be everywhere. Unless we will account him finite, we can render no reason why he should not be one creature as well as in another. If he be in heaven, which is his creature, why can he not be in the earth, which is as well his creature as the heavens? Reason 2. Because of the continual operation of God in the world, this was one reason which made the heathen believe that there was an infinite spirit in the vast body of the world, acting in everything, and producing those admirable motions which we see everywhere in nature. That cause, that which acts in the most perfect manner, is also in the most perfect manner present with its effects. God preserves all, and therefore is in all. The apostle thought it a good induction. Acts 17:27. He is not far from us, for in him we live. For being as much as because shows that from his operation he concluded his real presence with us. It is not his virtue, is not far from every one of us, but he, his substance himself, for none that acknowledge a God will deny the absence of the virtue of God from any part of the world. He works in everything. Everything lives and works in him. Therefore he is present with all. Or rather, if things live, they are in God, who gives them life. If things live, God is in them, and gives them life. If things move, God is in them, and gives them motion. If things have any being, God is in them, and gives them being. If God withdraws himself, they presently lose their being, and therefore some have compared the creature to the impression of a seal upon the water that cannot be preserved but by the presence of the seal. As his presence was actual with what he created, so his presence is actual with what he preserves, since creation and preservation do so little differ. If God creates things by his essential presence, by the same he supports them. If his substance cannot be disjoined from his preserving power, his power and wisdom cannot be separated from his essence. Where there are the marks of the one, there is the presence of the other. For it is by his essence that he is powerful and wise. No man can distinguish the one from the other in a simple being. God does not preserve and act things by a virtue diffused from him. It may be demanded whether that virtue be distinct from God. If it be not, it is then the essence of God. If it be distinct, it is a creature. And then it may be asked how that virtue, which preserves other things, is preserved itself. It must be ultimately resolved into the essence of God, or else there must be a running in infinitum, or else is that virtue of God a substance or not? Is it endued with understanding or not? If it have understanding, how does it differ from God? If it wants understanding, can any imagine that the support of the world, the guidance of all creatures, the wonders of nature can be wrought, preserved, managed by a virtue that hath nothing of understanding in it? If it be not a substance, it can be much less be able to produce such excellent operations as the preserving all kinds of things in the world, and ordering them to perform such excellent ends. This virtue is therefore God himself, the infinite power and wisdom of God. And therefore, wheresoever the effects of these are seen in the world, God is essentially present. Some creatures, indeed, act at a distance by a virtue diffused. But such a manner of acting comes from a limitedness of nature, that such a nature cannot be everywhere present and extend its substance to all parts. To act by a virtue speaks a subject finite, and it is part of indigence. Kings act in their kingdoms by ministers and messengers, because they cannot act otherwise. But God, being infinitely perfect, works all things in all immediately. 1 Corinthians 12:6. Illumination, sanctification, grace, etc., are the immediate works of God in the heart, and immediate agents are present with what they do. It is an argument of the greater perfection of a being to know things immediately, which are done in several places, than to know them at the second hand by instruments. It is no less a perfection to be everywhere, rather than to be tied to one place of action, and to act in other places by instruments, for want of a power to act immediately itself. God indeed acts by means and second causes in his providential dispensations in the world, but this is not out of any defect of power to work all immediately himself, but he thereby accommodates his way of acting to the nature of the creature and the order of things which he has settled in the world. And when he works by means, he acts with those means, in those means, sustains their faculties and virtues in them, concurs with them by his power, so that God acting by means does rather strengthen his essential presence than weaken it, since there is a necessary dependence of the creatures upon the Creator in their being and acting. And what they are by the power of God. What they act in the power of God, concurring with them. So they have their motion in him as well as their being, and where the power of God is, his essence is, because they are inseparable. And so this omnipresence arises from the simplicity of the nature of God. The more vast anything is, the less confined. All that will acknowledge God so great as to be able to work all things by his will, without an essential presence, cannot imagine him upon the same reason, so little as to be contained in and bounded by any place. Reason 3. Because of his supreme perfection. No perfection is wanting to God, but an unbounded essence is a perfection. A limited one is an imperfection. Though it be a perfection in a man to be wise, yet it is an imperfection that his wisdom cannot rule all the things that concern him. Though it be a perfection to be present in a place where his affairs lie, yet it is an imperfection that he cannot be present everywhere in the midst of all his concerns. If any man could be so, it would be universally owned as a prime perfection in him above others. Is that which would be a perfection in man to be denied to God? As that which hath life is more perfect than that which hath not life, and that which hath sense is more perfect than that which hath only life as the plants have, and what hath reason is more perfect than that which hath only life and sense as the beasts have. So what is everywhere is more perfect than what is bounded in some narrow confines. If a power of motion be more excellent than a bedrid, and swiftness in a creature be a more excellent endowment than be slow and snail-like, then to be everywhere without motion is inconceivably a greater excellency than to be everywhere successively by motion. God sets forth his readiness to help his people and punish his enemies, or his omnipresence, by swiftness, or flying upon the wings of the wind, Psalm 18:10. The wind is in every part of the air where it blows. It cannot be said that it is in this or that point of the air where you feel it, so as to exclude it from other part of the air where you are not. It seems to possess all at once. If the divine essence had any bounds of place, it would be imperfect, as well as if it had bounds of time. Where anything had limitation, it has some defect in being, and therefore if God were confined or concluded, he would be as good as nothing in regard of infiniteness. Whence should this restraint arise? There is no power above him to restrain him to a certain place. If so, then he would not be God, but that power which restrained him would be God, not from his own nature, for the being everywhere implies no contradiction to his nature. If his own nature determined him to a certain place, then if he removed from that place, he would be act against his nature. To conceive any such thing of God is highly absurd. It cannot be thought God should voluntarily impose any such restraint or confinement upon himself. This would be to deny himself a perfection he might have. If God have not this perfection, it is either because it is inconsistent with his nature, or because he cannot have it, or because he will not. The former cannot be, for if he hath impressed upon air and light a resemblance of his excellency, to diffuse themselves and fill so vast a space, is such an excellency inconsistent with the Creator more than the creature? Whatever perfection the creature hath, is eminently in God. Understand, O ye brutish among the people, and ye fools, when will you be wise? He that planted the ear, hear, shall he not hear? He that formed the eye, shall he not see? He that teacheth man knowledge, shall not he know? Psalm 94:8-9. By the same reason, he that hath given such a power to those creatures, air and light, shall not he be much more filling all spaces of the world? It is so clear a rule that the psalmist fixes a folly and brutishness upon those that deny it. It is not therefore inconsistent with his nature, if it were not then a perfection, but an imperfection. But whatsoever is an excellency in creatures, can it in a way of eminency be an imperfection in God? If it be then a perfection, and God want it is because he cannot have it. Where then is his power? How can he be then the fountain of his own being? If he will not, where is his love to his own nature and glory? Since no creature would deny that to itself which it can have, and is an excellency to it. God, therefore, hath only a power or fitness to be everywhere, but is actually everywhere. Reason 4. Because of his immutability. If God did not fill all the spaces of heaven and earth, but only possess one, yet it must be acknowledged that God hath a power to move himself to another. If we were observed to fix God in a part of the heavens, like a star in an orb, with the power of motion to another place. If he be therefore essentially in heaven, may he not be upon the earth, if he please, and transfer his substance from one place to another? To say he cannot is to deny him a perfection which he hath bestowed upon his creatures. The angels, his messengers, are sometimes in heaven, sometimes on the earth. The eagles, meaner creatures, are sometimes in the air out of sight, sometimes upon the earth. If he doth move, therefore, and recede from one place and settle in another, doth he not declare himself mutable by changing places, by being where he was not before, and in not being where he was before? He would not fill heaven and earth at once, but successively. No man can be said to fill a room that moves from one part of a room to another. If therefore any in their imaginations state God to the heavens, they render him less than his creatures. If they allow him a power of motion from one place to another, they conceive him changeable. And in either of them, they own him no greater than a finite and limited being. Limited to heaven, if they fix him there, limited to that space to which they imagine him to move. Reason 5. because of his omnipotency. The almightiness of God is a notion settled in the minds of all, that God can do whatsoever he pleases, everything that is not against the purity of his nature and does not imply a contradiction in itself. He can therefore create millions of worlds greater than this, and millions of heavens greater than this heaven. He hath already created. If so, he is then inconceivable spaces beyond this world, for his essence is not less narrower than his power. And his power is not to be thought of a further extent than his essence. He cannot be excluded, therefore, from those vast spaces where his power may fix those worlds if he please. If so, it is no wonder that he should fill this world, and there is no reason to exclude God from the narrow space of this world that is not contained in infinite spaces beyond the world. God is wheresoever he hath the power to act, but he hath the power to act everywhere in the world, everywhere out of the world. He is therefore everywhere in the world, everywhere out of the world. Before this world was made, he had the power to make it in the space where now it stands. Was he not then unlimited where the world now is, before the world received a being by his powerful word? Why should he not then be in every part of the world now? Can it be thought that God, who was immense before, should, after he had created the world, contract himself to the limits of one of his creatures, and to tie himself to a particular place of his own creation, and be less after his creation than he was before? This might also be prosecuted by an argument from his eternity. What is eternal in duration is immense in essence. The same reason which renders him eternal renders him immense. That which proves him to be always will prove him to be everywhere. 3. The third thing is, propositions for the further clearing this doctrine from any exceptions. 1. This truth is not weakened by the expressions in Scripture where God is said to dwell in heaven and in the temple. 1. He is indeed said to sit in heaven, Psalm 2:4, and to dwell on high, Psalm 113:5. But he is nowhere said to dwell only in the heavens as confined to them. It is the court of his majestical presence, but not the prison of his essence. For when we are told that the heaven is his throne, we are told, with the same breath, that the earth is his footstool, Isaiah 66:1. He dwells on high, in regard of the excellency of his nature, but he is in all places, in regard of the diffusion of his presence. The soul is essentially in all parts of the body, but it does not exert the same operations in all. The more noble discoveries of it are in the head and heart. In the head, where it exercises the chiefest senses for the enriching of the understanding, in the heart, where it vitally resides and communicates life and motion to the rest of the body. It doth not understand with the foot or toe, though it be in all parts of the body it informs. And so God may be said to dwell in heaven, in regard of the more excellent and majestic representations of himself, both to the creatures that inhabit the place, as angels and blessed spirits, and also in those marks of his greatness which he hath planted before, those spiritual natures which has a nobler stamp of God upon them, and those excellent bodies, the sun and stars, which are so many tapers light us to behold his glory, Psalm 19:1, and astonish the minds of men when they gaze upon them. It is his court, where he hath the most solemn worship from his creatures, all his courtiers attending there with a pure love and glowing zeal. He reigns there in a special manner, without any opposition to his government. It is therefore called his holy dwelling place, 2 Chronicles 3:27. The earth hath not that title, since sin cast a stain and a ruining curse upon it. The earth is not his throne, because his government is opposed, but heaven is none of Satan's precinct, and the rule of God is uncontradicted by the inhabitants of it. It is from thence also he hath given the greatest discoveries of himself. Thence he sends the angels, his messengers, his Son upon redemption, his Spirit for sanctification. From heaven his gifts drop down upon our heads, and his grace upon our hearts. James 3:17. From thence the chiefest blessings of earth descend. The motions of the heavens fatten the earth. The heavenly bodies are but stewards to the earthly comforts for man by their influence. Heaven is the richest, vastest, most steadfast and majestic part of the visible creation. It is there where he will at last manifest himself to his people in a full conjunction of grace and glory, and be forever open to his people in uninterrupted expressions of goodness and discoveries of his presence, as a reward of their labor and service. And in these respects it may peculiarly be called his throne. And this doth no more hinder his essential presence in all parts of the earth. And this doth no more hinder his essential presence in all parts of the earth than it doth his gracious presence in all the hearts of his people. God is in heaven in regard of the manifestation of his glory, in hell by the expressions of his justice, in the earth by the discoveries of his wisdom, power, patience, and compassion, in his people by the monuments of his grace, and in all in regard of his substance. 2. He is said also to dwell in the ark and temple. It is called, Psalm 26:8, the habitation of his house, and the place where his honor dwells. And to dwell in Jerusalem, as in his holy mountain, the mountain of the Lord of hosts, Zechariah 8:3, in regard of publishing his oracles, answering their prayers, manifesting more of his goodness to the Israelites than to any other nation in the world, erecting his true worship among them, which was not settled in any part of the world besides, and his worship is principally intended in that psalm. The ark is a place where his honor dwells. The worship of God is called the glory of God. They changed the glory of God into an image, made like to corruptible man. Romans 1:23. I.e., they changed the worship of God into idolatry, and to that also doth the place in Zechariah refer. Now, because he is said to dwell in heaven, is he essentially only there? Is he not as essentially in the temple and ark as he is in heaven, since there are as high expressions of his habitation there as of his dwelling in heaven? If he dwell only in heaven, how came he to dwell in the temple? Both are asserted in Scripture, one as much as the other. If his dwelling in heaven did not hinder his dwelling in the ark, it could as little hinder the presence of his essence on the earth. To dwell in heaven and in one part of the earth at the same time is all one as to dwell in all parts of heaven and all parts of earth. If he were in heaven and in the ark and temple, it was the same essence in both, though not the same kind of manifestation of himself. If by his dwelling in heaven he meant his whole essence, why is it not also to be meant by his dwelling in the ark? It was not, sure, part of his essence that was in heaven, and part of his essence that was on earth. His essence would then be divided. And can it be imagined that he should be in heaven and the ark at the same time, and not in the spaces between? Could his essence be split into fragments, and a gap made in it, that two distinct spaces should be filled by him, and all between be empty of him? So that God's being said to dwell in heaven and in the temple, in so far from impairing the truth of this doctrine, that it more confirms and evidences it. 2. nor do the expressions of God's coming to us or departing from us impair this doctrine of his omnipresence. God is said to hide his face from his people, Psalm 10:1, to be far from the wicked, and the Gentiles are said to be afar off, that is, from God, Proverbs 15:29, and Ephesians 2:17, and upon the manifestation of Christ made near. These must not be understood of any distance or nearness of his essence, for that is equally near to all persons and things, but of some other special way and manifestation of his presence. Thus God is said to be in believers by love, and they are in him. 1 John 4:15, he that abides in love abides in God, and God in him. He that loves is in the thing beloved. And when two love one another, they are in one another. God is in a righteous man by a special grace, and far from the wicked in regard of special works. And God is said to be in a place by a special manifestation, as when he was in the bush, Exodus 3, or manifesting his glory upon Mount Sinai, Exodus 24:16, the glory of the Lord abode about Mount Sinai. God is said to hide his face when he withdraws his comforting presence, disturbs the repose of our hearts, flashes terror into our consciences, when he puts men under the smart of the cross, as though he had ordered his mercy utterly to depart from them, or when he doth withdraw his special assisting providence from us in our affairs, so he departed from Saul, when he withdrew his direction and protection from him in the concerns of his government, 1 Samuel 16:14. The Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, i.e. the Spirit of government. God may be far from us in one respect, and near to us in another. Far from us in regard to comfort, yet near to us in regard of support, when his essential presence continues the same. This is a necessary consequence upon the infiniteness of God. The other is an act of the will of God. So he was said to forsake Christ in regard of his obscuring his glory from his human nature and inflicting his wrath, though he was near to him in regard of his grace and preserved him from contracting any spot in his sufferings. We do not say the sun is departed out of the heavens when it is ministered. It remains in the same part of the heavens, passes on its course, though its beams do not reach us by reason of a bar between us and it. The soul is in every part of the body, in regard of its substance, and constantly in it, though it does not act so sprightly and vigorously at one time as at another in one and the same member, and discovers itself so sensibly in its operations. So all the various effects of God towards the sons of men are but divers operations of one and the same essence. He is far from us, or near to us, as he is a judge, or a benefactor. When he comes to punish, it notes not the approach of his essence, but the stroke of his justice. When he comes to benefit, it is not by a new access of his essence, but an efflux of his grace. He departs from us when he leaves us to the frowns of his justice. He comes to us when he encircles us in the arms of his mercy. But he is equally present with us in both dispensations in regard of his essence. Likewise God is said to come down, Genesis 11:5, and the Lord came down to see the city, when he does some signal and wonderful works, which attracts the minds of men to the acknowledgement of a supreme power and providence in the world, who judged God absent and careless before. 3. Nor is the essential presence of God with all creatures any disparagement to him. Since it was no disparagement to create the heaven and the earth, it is no disparagement to him to fill them. If he were essentially present with them when he created them, it is no dishonor to him to be essentially present with them to support them. If it were his glory to create them by his essence, when they were nothing? Can it be his disgrace to be present by his essence, since they are something, and something good, and very good in his eye? Genesis 1:31. God saw everything, and behold, it was very good, and mighty good, all ordered to declare his goodness, wisdom, power, and to make him adorable to man, and therefore took complacency in them. There is a harmony in all things, a combination in them, for those glorious ends for which God created them. And is it a disgrace for God to be present with his own harmonious composition? Is it not a musician's glory to touch with his fingers the treble, the least and tenderest string, as well as the strongest and greatest bass? Hath not everything some stamp of God's own being upon it, since he eminently contains in himself the perfections of all his works? Whatsoever hath been, hath the footstep of God upon it, who is all being. Everything in the earth is his footstool, having a mark of his foot upon it. All declare the being of God, because they had their being from God. And will God account it any disparagement to him to be present with that which confirms his being and the glorious perfections of his nature to his intelligent creatures? The meanest things are not without their virtues, which may boast God's being the creator of them, and rank them in the midst of his works of wisdom as well as power. Doth God debase himself to be present by his essence with the things he hath made, more than he doth to know them by his essence? Is not the least thing known to him? How? Not by a faculty or act distinct from his essence, but by his essence itself. How is anything disgraceful to the essential presence of God? That is not disgraceful to his knowledge by his essence. Besides, would God make anything that should be an invincible reason to him to part with his own infiniteness, by a contradiction of his own essence, into a less compass than before? It was immense before, it had no bounds. And would God make a world that he would be ashamed to be present with, and continue in it to the diminution? And continue it to the diminution and lessening of himself, rather than annihilate it to avoid the disparagement? This were to impeach the wisdom of God, and cast a blemish upon his infinite understanding, that he knows not the consequences of his work, or is well contented to be impaired in the immensity of his own essence by it. No man thinks it a dishonour to light, a most excellent creature, to be present with a toad or serpent. And though there be an infinite disproportion between light, a creature, and the Father of lights, the Creator, yet God, being a spirit, knows how to be with bodies as if they were not bodies, and being jealous of his own honour, could not do anything that might impair it. 4. Nor will it follow that because God is essentially everywhere, that everything is God. God is not everywhere by any conjunction, composition, or mixture with anything on earth. When light is in every part of a crystal globe, and encircles it close on every side, do they become one? No, the crystal remains what it is, and the light retains its own nature. God is not in us as a part of us, but as an efficient and preserving cause. It is not by his essential presence, but his efficacious presence, that he brings any person into a likeness to his own nature. God is so in his essence with things as to be distinct from them, as a cause from the effect, as a creator different from the creature, preserving their nature, not communicating his own. His essence touches all, is in conjunction with none. Finite and infinite cannot be joined. He is not far from us, therefore near to us, so near that we live and move in him. Acts 17:28. Nothing is God, because it moves in him, any more than a fish in the sea is the sea, or a part of the sea because it moves in it. that a man that holds a thing in the hollow of his hand transform it by that action and make it like his hand, the soul and the body are more straightly united than the essence of God is, but his presence with any creature. The soul is in the body as a form in matter, and from their union remain distinct. The soul is not the body, nor the body the soul. They both have distinct natures and essence. The body can never be changed into a soul, nor the soul into a body. No more can God into the creature, or the creature into God. Fire is in heated iron in every part of it, so that it seems to be nothing but fire, yet it is not fire and iron the same thing. By such a kind of arguing against God's omnipresence, that if God were essentially present, everything would be God, would exclude him from heaven as well as from earth. By the same reason, since they acknowledge God essentially in heaven, the heaven where he should be changed into the nature of God. And by arguing against his presence in earth, upon this ground they run such an inconvenience that they must own him to be nowhere, and that which is nowhere is nothing. Does the earth become God because God is essentially there, any more than the heavens, where God is acknowledged by all to be essentially present? Again, if where God is essentially, that must be God, then if they place God in a point of the heavens, not only that point must be God, but all the world, because if that point be God, because God is there, then the point touched by that point must be God, and so consequently, as far as there are any points, touched by one another. We live and move in God, so we live and move in the air. We are no more God by that than we are mere air, because we breathe in it, and it enters into all the pores of our body. Nay, where there was a straighter union of the divine nature to the human in our Saviour, yet the nature of both was distinct, and the humanity was not changed into the divinity, nor the divinity into the humanity. 5. Nor doth it follow that because God is everywhere, therefore a creature may be worshipped without idolatry. Some of the heathens who acknowledged God's omnipresence abused it to the countenancing of idolatry. Because God was resident in everything, they thought everything might be worshipped. And some have used it as an argument against this doctrine. The best doctrines may be men's corruption, be drawn out into unreasonable and pernicious conclusions. Have you not met with any that from the doctrine of God's free mercy and our Saviour's satisfactory death have drawn poison to feed their lusts and consume their souls? A poison composed by their own corruption and offered by those truths. The Apostle intimates to us that some did, or at least were ready to be more lavish in sinning, because God was abundant in grace. Shall we continue in sin, that grace may abound? When he prevents an objection that he thought might be made by some, but as to this case, since though God be present in everything, yet everything retains its nature distinct from the nature of God, therefore it is not to have a worship due to the excellency of God. As long as anything remains a creature, it is only to have the respect from us which is due to it in the rank of creatures. When a prince is present with his guard, or if he should go arm in arm with a peasant, is therefore the veneration and honour due to the prince to be paid to the peasant or any of his guard? Would the presence of a prince excuse it, or would it not rather aggravate it? He acknowledged such a person equal to me by giving him my rights, even in my sight. Though God dwelt in the temple, would not the Israelites have been counted guilty of idolatry had they worshipped the images of the cherubims, or the ark, or the altar, as objects of worship, which were erected only as means for his service? Is there not as much reason to think God was as essentially present in the temple as in heaven, since the same expressions are used of the one and the other? The sanctuary is called the glorious high throne, Jeremiah 17:3, and he is said to dwell between the cherubims, Psalm 81, i.e. the two cherubims that were at the two ends of the mercy seat, appointed by God as the two sides of his throne in the sanctuary, Exodus 25:18, where he was to dwell, verse 8, and meet and commune with his people, verse 22. Could this excuse Manasseh's idolatry in bringing in a carved image into the house of God, 1 Chronicles 33:7? Had it been a good answer to the charge, God is present here, and therefore everything may be worshipped as God? If he be only essentially in heaven, would it not be idolatry to direct a worship to the heavens, or any part of it as a due object, because of the presence of God there? Though we look up to the heavens, where we pray and worship God, yet heaven is not the object of worship. The soul abstracts God from the creature. 6. Nor is God defiled by being present with those creatures which seem filthy to us. Nothing is filthy in the eye of God as his creature. He could never else have pronounced all good. Whatsoever is filthy to us, yet, as it is a creature, it owes itself to the power of God. His essence is no more defiled by being present with it than his power by producing it. No creature is foul in itself, though it may seem so to us. Doth not an infant lie in a womb of filthiness and rottenness? Yet is not the power of God present with it, in working it curiously in the lower parts of the earth? Are his eyes defiled by seeing the substance when it is yet imperfect, or his hand defiled by writing every member in his book? Psalm 139:15-16. Have not the vilest and most noisome things excellent medicinal virtues? How are they endued with them? How are those qualities preserved in them by anything without God or no? Every artificer looks with pleasure upon the work he hath wrought with art and skill. Can his essence be defiled by being present with them, or any more than it was in giving them such virtues and preserving them in them? God measures the heavens and the earth with his hand. Is his hand defiled by the evil influences of the planets or the corporeal impurities of the earth? Nothing can be filthy in the eye of God but sin, since everything else owes its being to him. What may appear deformed and unworthy to us is not so to the Creator. He sees beauty where we see deformity, finds goodness where we behold what is nauseous to us. All creatures, being the effects of his power, may be the objects of his presence. Can any place be more foul than hell, if you take it either for the hell of the damned, or for the grave where there is rottenness? Yet there he is, Psalm 139:8. When Satan appeared before God, and God spake with him, Job 1:7, could God contract any impurity by being present where that filthy spirit was, more impure than any corporeal, noisome, and defiling thing can be? No, God is purity to himself in the midst of noisomeness, a heaven to himself in the midst of hell. Whoever heard of a sunbeam stained by shining upon a quagmire any more than sweetened by breaking into a perfumed room? Though the light shines upon pure and impure things, yet it mixes not itself with either of them. So though God be present with devils and wicked men, yet without any mixture, he is present with their essence to sustain it and support it, not in their defection, wherein lies their defilement, and which is not a physical, but a moral evil. Bodily filth can never touch an incorporeal substance. Spirits are not present with us in the same manner that one body is present with another. Bodies can be a touch only, defiled bodies. Is the glory of an angel stained by being in a coal mine? Or could the angel that came into the lion's den to deliver Daniel be any more disturbed by the stench of the place than he could be scratched by the paws or torn by the teeth of the beasts? Daniel 6:22. Their spiritual nature secures them against any infection when they are ministering spirits to persecuted believers in their nasty prisons. Acts 12:7. The soul is straightly united with the body, but it is not made white or black by the whiteness or blackness of its habitation. Is it infected by the corporeal impurities of the body, while it continually dwells in a sea of filthy pollution? If the body be cast into a common shore, is the soul defiled by it? Can a diseased body derive a contagion to the spirit that animates it? Is it not often the purer by grace, the more the body is infected by nature? Hezekiah's spirit was scarce ever more fervent with God than when the sore, which some think to be a plague sore, was upon him, Isaiah 38:3. How can any corporeal filth impair the purity of the divine essence? It may as well be said that God is not present in battles and fights for his people, Joshua 23:10, because he would not be disturbed by the noise of cannons or the clashing of swords, as that he is not present in the world because of the ill sense. Let us therefore conclude this with the expression of a learned man of our own. To deny the omnipresence of God because of ill-scented places is to measure God rather by the nicety of sense than by the sagacity of reason. 4. Use. First of information. 1. Christ hath a divine nature, as eternity and immutability, two incommunicable properties of the divine nature are ascribed to Christ, so also this of omnipresence or immensity, John 3:13. No man hath ascended up to heaven, but he that came down from heaven, even the Son of Man which is in heaven. Not which was, but which is. He comes down from heaven by incarnation, and remains in heaven by his divinity. He was, while he spake to Nicodemus, locally on earth, in regard of his humanity, but in heaven according to his deity, as well as upon earth in the union of his divine and human nature. He descended upon earth, but he left not heaven. He was in the world before he came in the flesh, John 1:10. He was in the world, and the world was made by him. He was in the world as the light that enlightens every man that comes into the world. In the world as God, before he was in the world as man. He was then in the world as man, while he discoursed with the Nicodemus, yet so that he was also in heaven as God. No creature but is bounded in place, either circumscribed this body, as determined this spirit to be in one space, so as not to be in another at the same time, to leave a place where they were, and possess a place where they were not. But Christ is so on earth, that at the same time he is in heaven. He is therefore infinite. To be in heaven and earth at the same moment of time is a property solely belonging to the deity, wherein no creature can be a partner with him. He was in the world before he came to the world, and the world was made by him, John 1:10. His coming was not as the coming of angels that leave heaven and begin to be on earth where they were not before, but such a presence as can be ascribed only to God, who fills heaven and earth. Again, if all things were made by him, then he was present with all things which were made. For where there is a presence of power, there is also a presence of essence, and therefore he is still present, for the right and power of conservation follows the power of creation. And according to this divine nature, he promises his presence with his church. Matthew 18:20. Therefore am I in the midst of them. And Matthew 28:20. I am with you always, even to the end of the world, i.e. by his divinity, for he had before told them, Matthew 26:11, that they were not to have him always with them, i.e. according to his humanity, but in his divine nature he is present with, and walks in the midst of, the golden candlesticks. If we understand it, of a presence by his Spirit in the midst of the church, doth it invalidate his essential presence? No, he is no less than the Spirit whom he sends, and therefore as little confined as the Spirit is, who dwells in every believer. And this may also be inferred from John 10:30, My Father and I are one, not one by consent, though that be included, but one in power, for he speaks not of their consent, but of their joint power in keeping his people. Where there is a unity of essence, there is a unity of presence. 2. Here is a confirmation of the spiritual nature of God. If he were an infinite body, he could not fill heaven and earth, but with the exclusion of all creatures. Two bodies cannot be in the same space. They may be near one another, but not in any of the same points together. A body bounded he had not, for that would destroy his immensity. He could not then fill heaven and earth, because a body cannot be at one and at the same time in two different spaces. But God does not fill heaven at one time and the earth at another, but both at the same time. Besides, a limited body cannot be said to fill the whole earth, but one particular space in the earth at a time. A body may fill the earth with its virtue, as the sun, but not with its substance. Nothing can be everywhere with a corporeal weight and mass. But God, being infinite, is not tied to any part of the world, but penetrates all, and equally acts by his infinite power in all. This Reformation audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. Many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalogue containing classic and contemporary Puritan Reform books, CDs and much more at great discounts, are on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, AB, Canada, T6L3T5. If you do not have a web connection, please request a free printed catalogue. If you do have a web connection and would like to be added to our email list, please send an email to add@swrb.com or swrb@swrb.com with the word add in the subject line. SWRB's email list is a double opt-in list, so once you've sent us your email address, you will be asked by email to confirm you want to join our list using the email address you have supplied. Your email information will be kept confidential, and you can easily remove yourself from our email list by simply emailing us at swrb@swrb.com with the word remove in the subject line. Once you are on our email list, you will be alerted to all the new free Reformation resources, free MP3s, free electronic books and texts, etc. SWRB makes available on the web, as well as at times, to our best discounts and super specials. We also encourage you to reproduce this audio resource and to pass it on to your friends. But we only authorize this as long as the full contents of the message, including the header and trailer, is not altered in any way, and as long as the audio file or cassette is given away for free. Thank you again for listening to this SWRB reading. And remember that Isaiah 26:3 states, "Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee." 2 Corinthians 13:11 concludes, "Finally, brethren, farewell. Be perfect. Be of good comfort. Be of one mind. Live in peace. And the God of love and peace shall be with you."